This is Building Bridges with Kanesh and Mimi Rosenberg.
Building Bridges features Oscar Lopez Rivera on U.S. colonialism after Hurricane Maria. Oscar Lopez Rivera has been called the Nelson Mandela of Puerto Rico. Indeed, like the South African legend, Rivera was imprisoned for his anti-colonial activism and spent decades in prison. But in January 2017, after serving 35 years of his 70-year sentence, President Barack Obama, as one of his last acts in office, commuted Rivera's sentence. In May 2017, Oscar Lopez Rivera was a free man.
It's a great honor to be here, particularly in my home turf of Brooklyn, with Oscar Lopez Rivera. While I'm delighted and thrilled and enthusiastic to see somebody of your conviction and just an intrepid politics towards liberation, I am similarly demoralized looking at Puerto Rico, which seems to be even more firmly in the grip of colonialism by virtue of really a perfect storm, and that is the decimation from Maria, which was in many ways ushered in through the reality of colonialism and the fiscal control board, PROMISA, that has a stranglehold on the island. So how does one even begin at this period to organize and parse out the tasks towards a liberatory agenda for the island of Puerto Rico?
The most important element that we have to address in Puerto Rico are the most marginalized people, the working class, the poorest of the poorest community, because they have been the one most affected by the Hurricane Maria, but also by the decisions that have been made by the Fiscal Control Board, by FEMA, by the Army Corps of Engineers, by the government of Puerto Rico, that only does one thing, and that is to protect the interests of Washington, the interests of Wall Street. There's never been a main concern for the Puerto Rican people. But in this case, after Maria, the plight of the Puerto Rican people, especially the poorest of the poor, the working class, they're the ones who have suffered the most and continue suffering to this day. When the people have no roof over their heads, very little food or no food at all, when people have no water or a little bit of water, under those conditions, they need to be lifted. They need to be treated with dignity and respect. The saddest thing is that the ones who are the most vulnerable, the poorest of the poor, they are the ones who are viciously attacked. We are called, we're told, well, you're lazy, or you like dependence, you don't like to work, or you don't like to do things. But the facts are that Puerto Ricans are a hardworking people. The best example that I can use is that right after Hurricane Maria attacked, it was the Puerto Rican people, the ones who did the cleaning, the ones who did the work, the ones who were there to do and help the community in as much and in as many ways as they could themselves. Then all of a sudden we have this imposition on Puerto Rico, the Fiscal Control Board. We have FEMA, we have the Army Corps of Engineers, and then we have a colonial administration that only serves the colonizer. Those are the things that we need to be able to eradicate, to overcome, and the things that we need to transcend. And hopefully that as we reach out to the poorest community, as we reach out to the marginalized community, and those communities begin to work for themselves, to do things for themselves, to feel that they are empowered to do in Puerto Rico what needs to be done, I think that that is the most and the best way to move into a liberatory mindset, a liberatory spirit, and one that we hope will produce the decolonization of Puerto Rico.
One of the things that is also on the horizon, it's actually begun, is the decimation of the workforce. Now, along with a massive migration out because of the devastation from the hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico, there is the privatization now of essential sectors. There's the closing scheduled of 300 schools. There are the teachers, no doubt, who will lose their jobs as schools are privatized, taking from their model what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, where we had that kind of disaster capitalism that moved to privatize things. There's the water, there's the electrical union. So there's potentially massive loss of public sector jobs. How do you see that playing in, or what's happening and going to be happening to those workers as part of the process of building a real movement to assume control from Governor Rossello and from the junta?
Once a person loses his or her job, the only avenue open to them is to migrate. So that is right now the only option, because there are no jobs. And the little businesses that were affected by Maria, a lot of them have not been able to get started. I'll give you probably the best example. I was going to Rio Piedras, and the only way that they could operate the little businesses with the generators. You have a generator for 12 hours. It's a very expensive little apparatus. So if you are going to spend more money trying to maintain the little business open, if it's going to be costlier than profitable, most likely the owner will definitely close. You mentioned the 300 schools that have been proposed to be closed because the junta, the fiscal control board, has made the decision that those schools need to be closed, because the only way that they can privatize the schools is by closing them. It's an open door for the private sector to move in there. The same thing with electricity. The electricity has a long history in Puerto Rico. That is sad, because the best paid jobs in Puerto Rico were the ones with the electric company. And those workers fell asleep. They knew that when Donahue arrived in Puerto Rico, that she had a plan, and that plan was to privatize. They knew this, yet they did not move. They're trying to move now, and I went to a meeting 4 days ago, and it was sad because they were just starting to come together to see if they can stop privatization. And when we start at such a disadvantage, it's going to be very hard to stop privatization of the electric company. We have all the vultures surrounding that, because the companies will make a tremendous amount of money at the expense of Puerto Rico, because for the alleged government of Puerto Rico, because it's not a government, it's just people who work to administer the colony, for it to spend $2 billion to fix the infrastructure. But those $2 billion are right now, those $2 billion come out of the pockets of the Puerto Rican people, because it's part of the budget. Money that has been collected from the Puerto Rican people. Those $2 billion can be used for education. We don't have to close 300 schools. They closed 157 schools in August. And mostly all those teachers had to leave Puerto Rico. So that adds more and more to the brain drain that we suffer in Puerto Rico. And we've been suffering that for the last 18 years. So the future of Puerto Rico, and this is the plan, and I'm fairly certain that those who are behind this have already made good calculations. There's the gentrification in Puerto Rico, building very expensive condominiums. Those condominiums are not being for Puerto Ricans. The incentive for people who purchase those condominiums is like a 25-year non-taxes on those condominiums. If I were to buy a house tomorrow, I would be paying taxes on that building. So there's a difference. For me, it would be impossible to avoid paying the taxes. But yet a foreigner will have that advantage. Mm. So if I see gentrification, if I see this intensive campaign to privatize what is left of the public sector, because Puerto Rico privatized the airport, Puerto Rico privatized the telephone company, Puerto Rico privatized the tolls. And when we see how much of Puerto Rico has been privatized, it's scary. When the hospital was privatized, they said all kinds of positive things. Today, the conditions, the medical problems in Puerto Rico are the most serious ever. The structure that was left behind is useless. So they privatized the hospitals, and now we have the consequences. Because when Maria happened, none of those hospitals were ready to face the conditions. No electricity. They didn't have the wherewithal to start any kind of energy. A lot of people had to leave Puerto Rico. A lot of thousands and thousands of Puerto Rico who were sick, who were in hospital, were brought to the United States. Many people died because the hospital could not provide the structure to deal with their conditions. When we look at those things and we see what has happened in Puerto Rico, there's got to be a plan similar to what happened in Hawaii. The native population was little by little became smaller and smaller. More people from the 48 states moved there. And all of a sudden, Hawaii was made into a state. One of the probabilities, one of the possible goals is to depopulate Puerto Rico of Puerto Ricans. And if we see, we have over 5 million Puerto Ricans in the United States and probably less than 3 million in Puerto Rico right now. When we take the census in 2 years, we will see how much the reduction is. But I dare say that probably there are less than 3 million citizens of Puerto Rico living in Puerto Rico right now.
I'm also a legal aid lawyer, and one of the things that we are doing is we are processing Puerto Ricans who have come from the island here for various SNAP benefits and public assistance benefits. But the depopulation is really clear, and I would say that there's approximately 1 million people that have now filtered into New York. So along with the depopulation and your suggestion that Puerto Rico's development would be analogous to a kind of bedroom community for the mainland elite, given that kind of devastation, on one hand, you'd think the conditions are absolutely ripe for a revolutionary approach. On the other hand, similarly, is the devastation of a people and the decimation of a lot of the revolutionary groups that existed, from macheteros or people like yourself who spent commendably for your principles decades in the jail. So what is the organizing approach now? And do you have some sense that the moment can indeed be ripe for anti-colonialist, for independent ideas to take hold in the populace?
First of all, we're trying to create a movement to educate. For Puerto Ricans to have an appreciation of the potential that there is in Puerto Rico, because the potential is there. For example, if we look at the northern part of Puerto Rico, we have the Atlantic on the north, southern part we have the Caribbean. The water in Puerto Rico, an independent Puerto Rico, we have access to from 9 to 12 miles. And in that water, we can develop a fishing industry. We can use the water as a source of energy. We can use that water to promote ecotourism. And we can even use that water for alga. So we have, just with the water alone, we have one resource that will help us to create the economic base that we need. The other thing is, right now we have a lot of young people who are creating ecological agriculture, very small plots, but very effective. This is something that younger people are doing right now. We have also the potential of doing urban gardening, and we're promoting that. We're talking about solar energy, and we're planning, hopefully, that before the whole thing is privatized, that we can probably advance and do something with the solar energy. We have the human resource still to do the work, and that's the most important resource, to make Puerto Rico create a viable economy and to create a base. What we're doing right now is trying to educate the people, to learn, to see, to appreciate the potential that is there. One of the problems with colonized people is that they don't see the potential. They never see that they have the potential and the power within themselves to do things that are needed to be done in order for Puerto Rico to become an independent nation. One of the things, again, that I mentioned is that Puerto Ricans responded to the hurricane in a way that was very, very positive, very collective. We organized brigades that would go throughout Puerto Rico. We organized the medical brigades that would provide medical service. We had one brigade that did the dental service to poor community, to marginalized community. And the good thing is that in those communities where we have been working, people, the residents are talking about creating micro enterprises, small enterprises that they can control. The potential is there to make it viable. The things that we hear from the people, the conversations that we're having with the people, lead us to believe that we have the potential right now to decolonize Puerto Rico, to create the movement. It is difficult because independence in Puerto Rico has been so mistreated, so condemned, so criminalized, that it's very difficult for people to say, well, if I join an independence movement, I can be sent to prison. I could lose what I have. So there's that fear. So we have to make sure that people understand that it's within them. Part of the job that we have to do is to go into the community, organize them, radicalize them. Because the power is in those communities. The power is in the people. We have to go with the people. One of the problems that independentistas have had in the past has been that we have moved more toward an elite and less to the poor, to the marginalized. We have paid less attention to the communities that are probably the largest, numerically the largest, and have maintained ourselves very close to the Puerto Ricans, the professionals, the Puerto Ricans who have a better education. Independentistas are mostly in that category. And what we need to do now is for us to go into the communities, to really, really radicalize those communities, to show them that within them, each individual has the power to do something to make Puerto Rico the nation that it has the potential of being. There is no doubt in my mind that if within Puerto Rico we have the wherewithal to make Puerto Rico an independent and a sovereign nation with the potential of being a very strong small nation.
One of the realities, of course, is that I would call it a kind of neo-fascist administration. Its standard bearer is Trump, but he is stand-in for General Kelly and the entire Republican apparatus, and I dare say, certainly on international issues, considerable part of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the colonial, anti-colonial movement, which many of us turn to for inspiration and instruction, the time has passed. Mm-hmm. So how do you begin to rebuild an ideological sensitivity towards socialism, to cultivate an anti-capitalist sensitivity in the midst of what certainly appears to be the consolidation worldwide of capital? Your thoughts on that very, very complex thing of instilling a socialist ideology in the working class, in the peasant classes, and so on.
The best way to get people to understand the dynamics of socialism is by working together. If we have, for example, a fishing pond that is a cooperative, the whole community owns that, the whole community becomes self-sufficient with that, then that is one way of creating the example. Human beings usually respond to concrete examples. So the best way to educate is always to create concrete examples. People realizing that they have the power, if they come together and they work together, and it could be with schools, it could be with a factory, it could be as long as they begin to work together, equal benefits for everybody, equal opportunities for all of them, and they maintain that cohesiveness, I think that we will be on the way of creating the society that we really need. Problem with capitalism right now is probably more dangerous now than ever before. Especially in this country, they have been able to convince people that all the little gadgets that they buy, all of that is precious to them. And we can see thousands of people. Let's say that a telephone manufacturer makes a new telephone. They put it on the market, they advertise it, and we see millions of people moving to have access to a phone. We can see your Black Fridays. We can see how people, that gratification, that immediate gratification. In Puerto Rico, we see it. Lines of people shopping on credit, but that's immediate gratification. They have something. I've lived in this country for a long time, and I've seen how people begin to be more and more transforming themselves into commodities. Once the human being becomes a commodity, once the human being is commodified, then it's over. That is one of the things that really is happening here. Let's take education. I remember when education, you could have access not to the best, a real, real good education, because you were not going to come out of college being a critical thinker, but it was a better education than they have now, and people were not indebted. From 1980 to 2012, the debt of those who went to the university was $3 trillion debt. That apparatus was created, the banking industry, the people who make the loans. The whole thing of deregulating the banks, the whole thing of making a corporation a citizen, the whole thing of globalization, the whole thing of making sure that the environment can get destroyed and those who destroy it don't have any responsibility. That has been happening since 1971. They made a decision. They said, well, the problem in the United States, within the United States, is an excess of democracy, and we have to terminate that. And soon after that, all the little gains that civil rights movement had made were nullified. Everything went more and more to the right. And all of a sudden, we have a very right-wing government. And, by the way, it's not that the people, because the people, it is that they created an infrastructure where enough states will come together, and if in 2020, if Donald Trump runs again, those states with the Electoral College will elect whoever they want. It could be one worse, probably worse than Trump. Because the infrastructure has been created. That infrastructure has been created through the process of globalization, through the process of privatization. Who invented the privatization of education? How can education be transformed into a commodity? They did, sold. Because that's the only way that you can get an education. That has happened here, and it's happening in Puerto Rico, and it's happening in different parts of the world. So the pattern has been created, and it works for them. It works for capital. It doesn't work for us. The only way that we can respond to that is getting deep into the communities, getting deep into the poorest of the poor, getting them to really see, because they don't have anything. They don't have that much to lose. They can say, listen, you know, this is what we have. We can do it. We can work at it. We can create a system that is completely different. If we accept that as a goal, we can be in better shape than we are right now.
Now, we are moving here in a way that hasn't been seen for many decades. We do not have a movement, if you will, and we certainly don't have a movement that is thinking about assuming state power. It's essentially these siloized movements we have, reformist in nature, important, reformist in nature, not moving or thinking, as certainly I don't think that's really happened since the 30s, where we thought about the assumption of state power. Interestingly enough, we're way behind Europe, even in that. Having said that, certainly there are people who are aggressively responsive to the incredible chauvinism here, who are fundamentally anti-colonialist in nature. And so we do have that legacy of those movements from the 60s, the Black Power movement and all the indigenous groups and so on, and Puerto Rico groups and the anti-colonial struggles that were happening. Within that, what do you say is the message or the role here for those of us who would certainly like to be in a support capacity for our sisters and brothers who are fighting the good fight on the island of Puerto Rico? How do you see us mobilizing, and what do you need from us?
I think that there are several things. Right now there's a bill that has been pushed by two senators, Warren and Bernie Sanders. The American people can go behind that because it has to deal with the $74 billion odious debt that has been thrown on the laps of the Puerto Rican people. Also, right now, there are projects in Puerto Rico that, if helped economically, those projects can definitely advance. For example, you know, we have solar energy projects that will definitely can grow. All we need is basically for the people to see that solar energy can be to their benefit, not to depend on what is there right now. Alternatives play a very, very important role. Puerto Rico can definitely benefit from Puerto Ricans in the diaspora. Puerto Ricans in the diaspora can talk to the Americans in the United States and be advocates for what is happening in Puerto Rico. The most important element is, how is it that Puerto Rico can be helped in a way that is sustainable, in a way that can be maintained, can be pushed into a position that nobody will be able to destroy what has been created. I think that what is in the process of being created, there are projects that will guarantee the future of Puerto Rico. And I think that if we come into the United States and ask, help us economically to lift those projects, it will not be a tremendous amount of money. It will not be a costly project. It will be primarily done with the strength of the Puerto Rican people. Sometimes we surprise ourselves when we can rebuild a house just with very little and make it into a livable, adequate place. What we need most, people with skills, people who can help us, people, again, we need the human resource to help us too. So those are the things that I believe can be of help to us. But it cannot be a governmental structure. It cannot be FEMA. It cannot be Army Corps of Engineers. It has to come from the American citizens. It has to come from people who love freedom and justice and can see the potential that there is in Puerto Rico for liberation. Because the struggle, the people are there. We're there. And we know that the potential right now is there. Now, can we do it by ourselves? I don't think that we'll be able to do it by ourselves. We need the help, we need the support, we need the solidarity from throughout the world. And we're trying to get as much as we can, gain as much solidarity as we can. Unfortunately, it is the U.S. government that determines what gets into Puerto Rico and what doesn't get into Puerto Rico, because Cuba, Mexico, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Ecuador, Uruguay, those countries were trying to help Puerto Rico after the hurricane. And the United States prevented that, helped from getting there. So I think that's the most important thing that people can do.
Just want to say I'm honored. We certainly, in the community listening to this, pledge our support to you, to our comrades, our sisters and brothers in Puerto Rico, and for all that you have done to enhance our sensitivities about colonialism and, frankly, about what it means to commit to freedom and democracy and egalitarianism. Thank you. Thank you. It's been my pleasure. And I've been speaking with Oscar Lopez Rivera. Muchas gracias por todo.
Muchas gracias.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.